On this week's 51%, we speak with two women who use the power of art and culture in activism and have a book out that documents the Women's March.
I don't think that you can say that this movement is a white woman movement because the most marginalized voices have been at the leadership from the beginning.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Down to the rich man's house, and I took back what he stole from me.
Took it back.
While the women's marches from January have come and gone, activism and the fight for justice continue. Women's March Artistic Director Paola Mendoza and Strategic Advisor and National Organizer Sarah Sophie Flicker use the power of art and culture in activism. And for the one-year anniversary of the Women's March this past January, they released a book called Together We Rise, which documents the scenes behind the march before, during, and after. KALW's Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller spoke with these women, who are both national organizers for the Women's March and leaders of the Resistance Revival Chorus. These activist artists see their purpose as connecting fellow members of the Resistance to the moments of joy and transcendence that come with being part of history in the making. Mendoza begins.
Before Donald Trump was elected, I was a writer, director, a filmmaker, working in narrative films as well as documentary, and most of my films dealt with immigration, undocumented, specifically immigration. Post-Donald Trump, since the world exploded after Donald Trump, personally anyways, I started working and volunteering at the Women's March. So I was a national organizer for the Women's March and the artistic director of the Women's March. And in the year since the Women's March has happened, I've continued to work there, continued to do art, cultural activism stuff, as well as some films, but not so much anymore.
And Sarah Sophie.
Before the election, for a while now, I've been working in the cultural political space and sort of merging the two. So that's everything from a political theater group called the Citizens Band that I'm the creative director of and I do trapeze with. And I worked previously with Art Not War, making, you know, cultural campaigns for organizations like Emily's List. We worked sort of tangentially with the Clinton campaign and things of that nature. And since, I'd say, you know, 5 days after the election, I have been a national organizer at the Women's March. And the great love story of the Women's March is that Paola and I found each other, and now we get to make all this incredible work together.
So, Sarah Sophie,
I guess maybe like 3 or 4 months after the election, like a month or so after the Women's March, my husband was walking down the street with our 7-year-old, and they saw some circus thing. And my 7-year-old said, "Oh, mommy would have loved that if Hillary Clinton had won the election." And my husband told me that, and I was like, damn, I'm not going to let these steal my joy. And I was so grateful that, he had that, my 7-year-old had that insight, because then I ended up performing. And, you know, there's the part of this we can't normalize. And, like, I want to talk about that because it's so important. But also, like, you have to keep your life normal.
Well, Paola, I'd love to hear what your immigration story is. I mean, I know that it's been part of what drives you. You just said that. So tell us how that
so
worked for you.
I'm from Colombia. I was born in Colombia. My mom was very young when she had me. She had me at 22, and she had my brother when she was 18. And so she immigrated to the United States with my father, who had come a few months earlier. And so we immigrated to Los Angeles. So we were the only Colombians in L.A. the only ones. They were like, what are you? And so we came to the United States, to Los Angeles. We had no family here. My mom didn't speak English. She barely had a high school education. And then after a few months of being in the United States, my father abandoned us. So he left my mom at the age of 24 with a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old, no English, no family, no education, and with like $200 in her pocket. And so my mom made miracles happen every day. She made the impossible happen every day. And we went through being homeless. We went through living, being on welfare. We went through living in the projects. But through that, all of that, she was able to get an education herself. She went to community college. She worked at a fast food restaurant, and she says that she learned English from an Italian woman that didn't speak English. So to this day, my mom's English is cute, but not the best.
With an Italian accent.
Exactly. And so she put two kids through college. We both have our master's degrees. She, you know, we have our own families. We each own houses. Like, we, in many ways, are the epitome of the American dream. And that is the thing that we all need to fight for, no matter what aisle or how, what is your belief system. That is the thing that we need to fight for.
So what made you want to become a filmmaker?
You know, my road to being an artist is a very different road. As immigrant children, there is a lot of responsibility to make sure that your parents' sacrifices live up to the life that you're living. So that translates to being a doctor, being a lawyer, being a teacher, being something that is like very stable. So when I decided that I wanted to be an artist, my mom hit the fan. She was like, what are you talking about? She didn't talk to me for like 3 weeks. She was like, you can't do that. You're going to starve. I didn't come to this country for you to starve. No, 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 no. And I finally sat down and I told my mom, I was like, Mom, this is what I want to do. And the reason why I want to do it is because I found my voice. Like, I found a way in which I can express myself. This is who I am. And you can either support me or you cannot. But this is what I'm going to do. Since then, my mom has become my biggest fan. She loves everything that I do. But that responsibility, from feeling the responsibility of needing to be a lawyer, a doctor, or some sort of professional, has shifted to what are the types of stories that I'm telling, right? That's my responsibility. And so my responsibility as an artist, as a filmmaker, and even as an activist now, is to shine a light on women in particular whose stories we don't often hear, who we walk by on the street and we ignore them. And to me, those women are the women that I grew up with, and they're the unsung heroes of America. They are the fabric of America, the dishwashers, the janitors, the caregivers, the caretakers. And so that now, and has been my goal as a filmmaker, is to tell those stories with love, tell those stories with dignity, because so often those stories are told in salacious and untruthful ways, and tell those stories honestly so that those stories can be the bridge to other Americans and other people around the world.
Okay, Sarah Sophie. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear a bit more about your background and what led you to being interested in women's issues and women's rights and how art has played a role in that for you over the last few years.
I mean, a critical part of my background, Paolo now loves the story, makes me tell it. I only started telling it this year. But I think like something foundational for me is, so I'm Danish. I was born in Denmark. My mom's Danish. My dad's American. And the story goes, and it's, you know, a bit of a myth and possibly disputed at times, but I choose to believe it, is so my mother's grandfather was, in fact, the prime minister of Denmark, and he brought democratic socialism to Denmark. And when the Nazis invaded Denmark, the story goes that it was my great-grandfather's idea for the king to wear a star and to tell the police force to wear a Jewish star. And then what ended up happening is most of the population put on a Jewish star, and it was impossible for the Nazis to tell who was who. And in my mind, that's such a great act of, it's creative resistance. It is an act of solidarity. And that's always a story that's stuck with me. And then my father initially was at the Justice Department during the Voting Rights Act and spent a lot of time in the South making sure people could vote. So that's just sort of where I come from.
Right, it runs through your blood.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the women's rights and justice stuff, you know, I've always been more interested in intersectional feminism. And, you know, I went to Mills College. I came up in San Francisco during the tail end of the AIDS crisis and had a lot of friends die, and was a big ACT UP was a big part of, you know, my late teens and early 20s. So, you know, I guess coming from that background, I naively assumed we were further along as far as like the intersectional component of feminism. And it really wasn't until organizing the Women's March that I truly felt like, oh, this is what intersectionality is. You know, I've been pushing and pushing and trying, but I don't think we're as far along as we think we are. And certainly, you know, the way that white women continue to vote proves that. And you know, just a whole confluence of things that led me to this.
How did the Women's March get off the ground? For the record, the story goes,
you know, there was Teresa Shook. She put her idea up on Facebook because she had this idea and she was angry. She was an organizer. She'd never organized before in her life. She lived in Hawaii. She puts it on Facebook. She's like, I'm going to watch on March on Washington on January 21st. Who's with me? She goes to sleep. She wakes up. It's 10,000 people are saying she's coming. She's like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. So she connects with Bob Bland. Bob Bland then connects with a whole bunch of other women, white women. All of them are white. They're not organizers. And some of them, one of them, I don't know who, actually says, like, let's call it the Million Woman March. So that explodes on Facebook, really because of the historical problems that feminism has had with white women and women of color, in particular, black women. So that wound, and it's a generational wound, reopens. And those women, I have to say, those five women or six white women that were organizing at that time realized, oh, well, we don't have any women of color leading this with us. We need to reach out and we need to find women of color. So Vanessa Rubble was one of those women. She reaches out to Michael Skolnick. Michael Skolnick calls Linda, Tamika, and Carmen, who are the national co-chairs along with Bob Bland, and they come on board. The damage was done, right? And what we did, what I spent a lot of my time and a lot of the other women of color organizers from the Women's March spent our time on was reaching out to our communities to say, hey, yeah, they f***ed up in the beginning, but now this is a different organization. It's all of us and we are leading this. And so what I said during that time is, look, we don't have one woman of color at the table. We don't have two. We actually have like eight women of color leading this thing. Like, we are at the table creating the vision, the policy, the unity principles, what this is going to be. If we don't show up now, then when are we going to show up? And the reality is that most women that showed up at the Women's March, at the March on Washington, were white. Like, that's the reality. But we had a lot of women of color, and we presented an intersectional movement, and we did it in a way in which, for the first time on a main stage, was happening in the United States. We did not come up with that concept. Kimberly Crenshaw did in the 80s. But nonetheless, we said, okay, here's this idea, America. Run with it. And they have, and they did. And people are fumbling through it and learning and trying to figure it out. But I don't think that you can say that this movement is a white woman movement, because the most marginalized voices have been at the leadership from the beginning.
So thinking about the role of art again in bringing more people into the movement and more women of color into the movement, did art play a role in doing that as well as making sure that, you know, the women who were actually organizing it were diverse?
Yeah, art played a huge role in the organization of the Women's March. And, you know, we ended up with, you know, over 150 you know, really well-respected, well-known artists who we leaned on very heavily to lead the charge on this stuff, you know, because we were getting so much pushback. But, you know, when America Ferrera or Yara Shahidi or Tracy Ellis Ross posts about their support of the Women's March, suddenly, you know, a whole new audience has opened up to us. Paola can speak more to this, but we partnered with an organization called Amplifier, and all the most iconic artwork that, you know, is now so, you know, visually, like, you're like, oh, it's a Women's March, you know, oh, that's the resistance. That all came out of our partnership with Amplifier, who we continue to work with. You know, our consideration for who was going to be on the stage, which Paola led, was incredibly intentional. And, you know, the collaboration that we had with artists and, you know, the work we did on social media and the work that we did in our messaging, I would say were, you know, a big part of the success.
And I would just say, so we had incredible honorary co-chairs that were part of the Women's March. Gloria Steinem was one, Dolores Huerta was another, Angela Davis, LaDonna Harris. And then we had Mr. Harry Belafonte was also one of our honorary co-chairs. And we organized out of his offices. That was Women's March headquarters. He lent us his offices, which was incredible. And one night, it was in December and it was very cold because I remember very clearly. It was late night. Mr. B, as we like to call him, Mr. B showed up at the office as a surprise. And Mr. B, at that time, he was 89, 90 years old. He had recently had a stroke, so he came in with his walker. So it was a big deal for him to be there. And my son happened to be there that night, too, because I hadn't seen him for a while. So we're sitting at the table, at his table in his office. My son's on his lap. Mr. B sitting there, and he is just like the most brilliant mind still. And he's telling us stories about his time while he organized the civil rights march, the March on Washington. And, you know, he had Bob Dylan there and Joan Baez there and Lena Horne there. Like, he got all of the artists there. That was his role, his job. And he said to us, and this is something that really has stuck with me, and he said it before, obviously, but it has been kind of our North Star, my North Star during this time. And he said, when the movement is strong, the music is strong. And we see that now where we are. Our movement is very strong. And we see how art and specifically music is being influenced by the movement. You know, again, going back to Black Lives Matter, there is no Lemonade by Beyoncé without Black Lives Matter, right? Black Lives Matter moved, inspired, and forced Beyoncé to tell that record, to tell those stories. And we can, same thing with Kendrick Lamar. Like, there is no Kendrick Lamar. He's an amazing lyricist. He's an amazing rapper. But what made him great in that moment was the movement that was happening around him. So where we are today with women, we are starting to see the influence of this new women's movement in the art that is happening and is stemming from today.
Paola, what's the best advice that you've ever been given about finding your voice?
The best advice, and it really, as everything kind of in my life goes back to art and being an artist, the best art is the art that comes closest to the truth. And so I think with regards to finding my own voice, it's what is my truth? And that is a lifelong journey. And truth, my truth will also change throughout that journey. And I think it's both of those things, constantly searching for the truth and being willing to pivot when the truth turns to another direction.
Sarah Sophie. What's...
I mean, I don't know that anyone's ever given me any great advice. I mean, I think about this.
No one?
Well, I mean, not specifically to that question, you know. I'm like a white lady who has a pretty big platform. I don't know that I've ever had a problem with my voice per se, you know, other than like the inherent, you know, men speaking over you and mansplaining and all that great stuff. You know, so for me, it's a question of like, you know, I think listening is a big part of my voice. I think like I finally come to a place with myself where, you know, we talk so much about raising our girls to be courageous, to be brave, to be fierce. And I know that I'm brave, but like, do I think I embody the things that like the quote unquote feminist movement has been pushing out? Not necessarily. What I'm really interested in is uplifting like the part of myself which I know is the strongest, which is like my vulnerability and my ability to listen and my ability to like think outside of experiences that directly affect me, my compassion, my empathy. I like the fact that I'm not like a yeller and I don't engage in fighting. I want to uplift like qualities of nurturing and caregiving. And I want to extend those qualities to my sons. And in general, I want to broaden this conversation for boys. I think we spend so much time talking about our girls and we spend no time talking about our boys. And if we're flummoxed over how this whole Me Too movement came about, let's look at our boys. Let's start talking about that. My daughter's 10. We're reading books. We have copious books about puberty and, you know, feminism and all and websites. And I just took her to the Teen Vogue Summit. And, you know, it's a privilege that I get to take her to these things, that I'm invited to these things. There's nothing. I don't even know if my boys would be well, you know, they're young, but I don't know if where they would be welcome or where this conversation is happening for them. And, you know, part of like where this moment needs to get to is, you know, like I said earlier, I think, you know, this moment was uplifted because white women who are privileged are speaking out. And that's amazing. I think, you know, something that's been troubling to me is how there are absolutely monsters out there, and I am happy to throw them all under the bus. I am not happy to throw all men under the bus, and I want to help create pathway and a language and a narrative where we can bring them in. So let your voice be your voice. And you don't necessarily have to be fierce or courageous or angry or brave. And sometimes those things play themselves out in more traditionally like female ways. And that's great. That's okay. I value those things.
That was Paula Mendoza and Sarah Sophie Flicker speaking about art and culture in activism. Their book that came out around the one-year anniversary of the Women's March is entitled Together We Rise, Behind the Scenes at the Protest Heard Around the World. They were speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco.
Well, I went down to the White House and I took back what they stole from me.
Maryland women impregnated by rapists have new legal power to end the parental rights of their attacker. That's under a new law signed by Republican Governor Larry Hogan. Hogan signed it in mid-February, putting the emergency legislation passed unanimously into effect immediately. Advocates have been pushing for the bill for about a decade. The woman must provide clear and convincing proof that the man raped her. That's lower than the beyond a reasonable doubt threshold needed for criminal convictions. Some civil liberties-minded lawmakers had opposed the idea to avoid revoking the rights of people who have not been convicted of a crime. Supporters credited a growing sense of female empowerment for making the issue a priority this year. About 45 states and the District of Columbia limit parental rights of rapists. Britain will consider pardons for suffragettes convicted during the struggle for women's right to vote. That's according to the Interior Minister. And this comes a century since female voters won the right to go to the polls. Home Secretary Amber Rudd said she would take a look at the cases of women who were prosecuted during the pro-suffrage campaign more than 100 years ago. February 13th marked the 100th anniversary of the Representation of the People Act, which extended voting rights to all British men aged 21 and up, and to millions of women over 30. British women did not get the same voting rights as men until 1928. Suffragettes used public protests, civil disobedience, and occasionally violence in their campaign for women's votes. More than 1,300 were arrested and many were jailed. Campaigners have called for convicted suffragettes to receive posthumous pardons, citing the precedent of pardons given to gay men who were convicted of now-abolished offenses for homosexuality. Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the main opposition Labour Party, said that if elected, he would pardon the suffragettes and give an official apology for the miscarriages of justice and wider persecution they suffered. Prime Minister Theresa May, Britain's second female leader, used the anniversary to call for more civility in politics, saying some women are deterred from entering politics because of the abuse they face. And in a speech, May said the government was considering introducing a new offense of intimidation of parliamentary candidates and campaigners. She said, quote, "In the 21st century, it cannot be acceptable for any woman or any person to have to face threats and intimidation simply because she or he has dared to express a political opinion." End quote. And she promised to work for a democracy in which every voice is heard. Also out of Britain, the UK film industry has announced a plan to tackle bullying and sexual harassment backed by stars including Emma Watson and James Bond producer Barbara Broccoli. Organizations including the UK's Film Academy, the British Film Institute, and unions have united behind a set of principles in response to urgent and systemic issues. They said the goal is to eradicate bullying and harassment and support victims more effectively. The measures include procedures for reporting and investigating abuse, a commitment to take appropriate action against bullies and abusers, and a confidential support line. Films will have to sign up to the principles to receive funding from the BFI, which hands out tens of millions of pounds to new productions each year. Former Harry Potter star Emma Watson said the principles are not just about protecting individuals, but are also an important step in embracing a greater diversity of voices in the industry. Scores of entertainment figures have been accused of sexual harassment and abuse since women came forward to accuse Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein last year. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1492.